Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Rosenberg on behalf of the appellant in this case, Holly Speaks. Ms. Speaks could not be here today. She lives in Grand Junction and regrets that she can't be here to watch this. With me at council table is Zachary Wurzel, who tried the case up in Jefferson County with me. I don't think what is, and I'm planning to reserve a good portion of my time for rebuttal because I don't believe that there's really much for you to decide here. I think it's already been decided. This collateral source rule, the evidence was permitted over objection. There were two separate motions in limine that were filed with respect to collateral source evidence. The trial court decided that in his judgment, based on a number of district court rulings that had been provided to him by the defendants. So some other district court rulings where the district courts had found that the evidence of the amounts paid by health insurance as well as evidence of the amounts billed could both be introduced into evidence because the evidence of the amounts paid was some reasonable basis for the jury assessing the provided some evidence for the jury to make an assessment of the value of the plaintiff's medical services.
Let me give you. Let's assume about deciding that we agree with you that the collateral source. What other issues, if any, do you want us to decide and why?
I think that I have to tell you a real big issue I think here was this accident reconstruction expert, Mr. Mayle. And the reason it was so important was because there was a factual dispute at trial between Officer Rush, who estimated Mr. Ellis's speed at 20 miles per hour at the time he collided with the back of Ms. Speaks' parked vehicle. So 20 miles per hour, pretty significant speed. Mr. Mayle, and this is ignored in the briefs completely, and was also ignored, I don't know exactly why, by the district court, but Mr. Mayle, one of the opinions he had in his report was an opinion on the speed of the estimated speed of this accident, and it was based on physical assessments as opposed to a personal observation like Officer Rush. But the kind of thing that's admitted in courtrooms throughout the country, accident reconstruction experts will often come in and look at the data and make a decision as to whether or not. And so the reason why it was important, and frankly, there's not a whole lot of evidence of this in the record because we actually asked to speak to Mr. Mayle or to depose him, and the trial court said, well, in light of my ruling that he doesn't get to testify at all, you don't even get to go talk to him to find out what the basis for these opinions were, whether or not we were going to be able to lay sufficient foundation to get them in. None of that's in the record because of the court's ruling, and we cited it footnote 4 of our opening brief, because of the court's ruling that we're not allowed to talk to Mr. Mayle, and that was all predicated on this idea that he was speaking to this threshold forces and whether there's some level below which if you're not hit with sufficient severity that somehow you can't sustain an injury. That's essentially, and what's even more ironic in this case is that the defendants introduced that exact same evidence through their medical doctor. So the same evidence they said an accident reconstruction expert can't introduce on the threshold forces. But that's getting beside the point. Getting back to I really think that we should be allowed in the next trial to present an accident reconstructionist, whether it's Mr. Mayle, whether we have to get somebody else. I think that's important.
What other issues, if any? We've got the collateral source. We've got the reconstruction. Are there any other issues that you really want us to address, or are they going to be variable depending on how the evidence comes in trial two?
Well, Dr. Sanders, certainly that evidence that he was 78 years old and had a conversation with the hospital. And the hospital, and at the conclusion of that, this was evidence that the trial court on a motion in limine had initially said this is way too prejudicial because it makes it look like the doctor caused this thoracic outlet syndrome, and he wasn't a non-party designee, and you know, it certainly I think that that's one reasonable possibility of what happened here. So I'm but I'm concerned at this point, you know, Dr. Sanders, you know, with his advanced age, we may end up looking at a former testimony kind of exception to the hearsay rule and saying, because I don't, he's not treating anymore, and I don't want to say something that's not accurate, but for some reason I was thinking maybe there was, that he had some health issue and that might preclude us from calling him. So anyway, but that's certainly an issue. The idea that because I asked him a question that every doctor in the land would answer yes to, which was the question of, do you take surgery lightly? Just to impress that he believed this was a real concern, because the defense was trying to insinuate it wasn't a real, that these weren't real accidents, these weren't real injuries, they couldn't have caused this. I said, did you take this surgery lightly? And the answer was no. And now somehow they get to tell the jury about this evidence that the trial court had already found shouldn't come in, that his privileges, and then the way that it was used, when you look at and how defendant Ellis's counsel used and the colloquy with Dr. Sanders, it comes out very clearly that the jury couldn't have helped but notice that, yes, in fact, what this doctor did was, you know, because in 80%, I think the testimony was 80% of the time, when you have this surgery, it comes out better. People get better. She was in that 20% group that don't get better. And now, and there were complications testified to by Dr. Sanders in the surgery. So when you add it all together, you start talking about his privileges, you know, and they haven't, there's no certificate of review that was filed. There's no, you know, they're essentially, you know, creating an insinuation of medical malpractice here, which, you know, I don't think they should have. So I would say that's the other one. I will confer with Mr., or I'll ask him to write me a note while I sit down, unless there are more questions now, about any other issues that we might have that we might want you to address in this opinion. But that's all that I can think of off the top of my head.
Because if Dr. Sanders is around in trial too, and you call him as a witness, then you don't ask him if he takes surgery lightly, and then the issue doesn't come up.
That would be one way to approach it as well, Your Honor. I appreciate that. With that said, unless there are other questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. Teresa Seymour, 18420. I believe there's no evidence here that would not allow us to affirm and affirm the jury's verdict and affirm judge or the trial court judge in this case. The issue of the collateral source really isn't the issue here. Really, the issue is whether there was enough evidence that would support the jury's verdict, and I would submit to you that there is, clearly. The trial court judge, he determined, first off, whether there should be the issues of bill be paid. And he determined, yes, there should be. But he looked at the collateral source reason, and he looked at the case law that existed at the time. And he says, with the well-reasoned analysis, that the fact that there is evidence that there is a certain amount that is billed and a certain amount is paid, that is relevant in and of itself to show reasonable medical expenses. He says the proposed evidence, the next question he analyzed is whether this evidence would violate the collateral source rule. And according to our trial judge, in his wisdom and his analysis, he said, no, it does not violate the collateral source rule.
Isn't he dead wrong?
I don't believe he is. He distinguished Tucker. He said, this isn't a Tucker case. This is clearly a case that would rely on case law from as early as 1960 in Kendall, and then the Lawson case of Safeway, which that rule was always reasonable medical expenses would be necessary to determine the reasonable value of what was incurred. So no, that was the rule. That's how our trial court ruled. He said that is clearly relevant, and that's the way it went. One of the issues that the plaintiff claimed is that there was not even sufficient evidence to support the verdict, therefore it resulted in inadequate damages. Based on the evidence they received, which the plaintiff introduced their exhibit, which included the bill be paid information, the defense had two issues of bill be paid, both setting forth the information that our trial court judge determined was relevant in this case. The fact is, all the testimony about the first accident of August of 2005 said it was a minor low-speed impact, little to no property damage. The plaintiff herself said there was no injury. She didn't believe that she was injured at the time. Mr. Ellis, my client, testified he wasn't injured. He testified he didn't see any visible property damage. There is evidence for the jury so that they could say this was a minor low-speed rear-end impact in and of itself that would not have been thought to cause the nature and extent of the plaintiff's injuries. My expert testified that in his opinion, based on all the evidence that he had, and he looked at complete medical records that were available to him, also the information from the 2006 accident, and said it appeared to him that in this case, it would be reasonable for the plaintiff, after such a minor event, where she would be reasonable for her to go to one follow-up visit from her primary care physician, which that's exactly what she did. She went to her primary care physician. She complained of minor aches and pains, nothing specific. Her primary care physician, who had treated her for a number of years, prescribed medicines for her that would have allowed muscle relaxants and pain medicines, and said, if you need follow-up, please follow up. Well, that opportunity was given to the plaintiff. She did not follow up. In fact, she saw the doctor in December, where she didn't report any accident problems. She saw the doctor again in February. She didn't respond or didn't follow up any accident-related injuries. In fact, she had a cold in December. She needed a lesion removed from her nose in February, but she saw the primary care physician. It wasn't until March, 8 months after the accident, that she complained of some kind of vague muscle soreness, muscle tenderness. At that time, the doctor said, maybe some PT, physical therapy, would do you good, but it's a limited physical therapy. You should do that and follow up if you need to. The plaintiff sought 10 physical therapy treatments. Before she had the May 2006 accident, she was ready for discharge. The jury could have clearly found that she didn't have any treatment, that she was almost at MMI before the May of 06 accident. It was after the May of 06 accident that all of a sudden the medical bills went from $2,500 to $117,000. That was before the jury. There was no doubt, no question about it. So that when they indicated that they knew that there was a reason for a $15 verdict, that was the reason. They thought it was a minor low-speed accident, big treatment gaps, everything that was argued by the defense, everything that was argued by defense doctors. So that would even confirm more the trial court judge's rulings on the
issue. Sorry, I'm losing this a little bit. Are you saying harmless error because of other evidence in the record that would support essentially a nominal damage award?
Exactly.
How can we sit as a 13th juror and start weighing the evidence?
I don't think that you can. I think that the jury made a decision based on all the evidence, and they determined they had another and sufficient evidence to determine that causation was the issue. And this minor low-speed accident, it's a question of fact for the jury. They said
if they award any damages, doesn't that compel the conclusion that they resolved causation against you?
Absolutely not, because Dr. Burton said it would be reasonable to have one follow-up with your primary care physician, which is what they did. If they thought it was with the issue of the collateral source and the exhibits that were in evidence by the plaintiff and by the defendants, the bottom line there was $30,000. It would have been a $30,000 verdict, not a $15 verdict. A $15 verdict would just say, look, we question causation. That's, I think, the only thing that you can conclude that they did. They had the evidence before them, and I think it's more likely than not that they did that.
So the $117,000, only about $30,000 was paid? Is that what the math you're telling me?
I'm excuse me.
of the $117,000 in total medical expenses, was there only about $30,000 paid as a result of the insurer discount, or is it the insurer discount reduces the $117,000 by $30,000?
My understanding from exhibits from the plaintiff and the two defendants, the total medical billings were $117,000. What was actually paid was $30,000. So when Dr. Burton, the doctor, the expert for the defendant, testified that he believed that one treatment was necessary, I think that they relied on that and determined, and he also testified that he did not believe that this accident resulted in the kind of complaints that she had surgery for from Dr. Sanders. He looked at the treatment gaps, he looked at her symptomology, he looked at her pre-existing conditions, and issued of that. I do briefly want to look at the issue of Dr. Burton's testimony and the claim that they weren't able to adequately cross-examine him. Again, Dr. Burton, the defense IME doctor in this case, although when he testified, he never testified by any accident reconstruction issue. He testified on the basis of the medical review, his physical examination of the plaintiff, and that's how he got to his opinions that one trip would be necessary for the primary care physician. There is another independent medical examination doctor who also did not believe that thoracic outlet was caused by the either accident. So I think that was very important. Mr. Mayle, he was the subject of a Schultz v. Wells motion in limine, which was granted properly by the trial court, in that Mr. Mayle had purported to have opinions of a threshold for an injury causation. That evidence was properly stricken by the trial court, therefore...
Was it stricken because it was totally incompetent for more, or was it stricken because the court took evidence and made a decision that the proposed evidence was not reliable? Because it looks to me from reading the court's order that it simply said, Schultz says this was inadmissible there, therefore it's inadmissible here. Which I don't follow, given that Schreck requires a factual-based analysis, and given that the evolution of science can make something that may have been unreliable 10 years ago perfectly acceptable today.
No evidence of Mr. Mayle's credentials were even brought up. They weren't even before the court. He was testifying as an accident reconstructionist, but not as an engineer. He had no specialized training. That was evident from the motion in limine. I believe that the trial court judge did do a full Schreck analysis and then also applied Schultz v. Wells when he determined that this evidence was not admissible, and held so in the weeks before we went to trial, so that everybody would know that that testimony was not to be brought up at trial. It was a subject of a granted motion in limine.
Let me ask you, let's assume we reverse on the collateral source issue. What other questions do you think we should decide, as opposed to leaving them to come up as they may or may not on retrial?
The evidence fully supports this verdict.
I'm not asking you to concede the point. Let's just assume.
To concede the point of collateral source.
Right.
Okay, so you want to know what I believe are the main issues.
No, I want to know what other issues, if any, do you believe should be addressed in an opinion if that opinion starts out reversing and remanding for a new trial on collateral source because of collateral source.
I would think that the trial court would be adequately affirmed. What they ruled on was subject to motions in limine, motions for determination as a matter of law, and there would be no reason to rehash those. I mean, the same evidence that would be in place for the trial would be in...
I'm making this...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Plaintiff raises a number of issues in addition to collateral source. If we reverse and remand for collateral source error, is it your position that we should nevertheless take up those issues, even if we may side with you on them, or should we just leave some or all of them to come up at the second trial because they may come up differently?
Assuming that you are going to order a new trial on Collateral Source, I would believe that that would be the only issue then. It would be damages. Everything else could be affirmed by the trial court and that jury. The issues of Dr. Burton, Mr. Mayle, Dr. Sanders, the jury instructions, the issues of causation.
I think we should address them all.
Well.
And affirm
yes,
what the trial court.
And affirm them all. Affirm the trial court's rulings and the jury's verdict.
Ms. Seymour, I neglected to inquire whether you and the other defense counsel are going to split this argument. I'm sorry I didn't do that. But
yes, we are.
All right.
And it is your turn. Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Maria Lisa Irwin, 14770, on behalf of Appellee Briel. I understand the focus of the court's attention here to be the collateral source and potential reversal. I'd like to address the harmless error issue, if I might. With respect to that issue, I think what's telling with respect to the evidence, as we've cited in our brief, is all the evidence that came in on paid came in through plaintiff's own testimony and plaintiff's own evidence. So the conclusion and the harm, the substantial harm that could be alleged from the admission of that evidence doesn't exist here.
Wasn't that would be invited error, wouldn't it?
Pardon?
That would be invited error if you're truly contending that the plaintiffs brought this on themselves or on herself by introducing the evidence.
Well, the evidence that they brought in doesn't impair, it eliminates the substantial harm. There's no proof that there was a substantial
difference between 117,000 and 30,000 is not substantial.
Well, let's look at it this way. If you look at the verdict that was issued to Ellis, what the jury actually did there was they took the $86, which was the amount billed. So they used that amount. That amount came right out of the exhibits. What they took out was the amount paid. What was left was the $15. They used plaintiff's theory, which is you need to consider, and the evidence you should use in making your decision here is the amount billed. And that's exactly what they did. And I think if you look at their analysis on that determination, there's no reason to think that was done any differently as it applies to Rail. The Rail verdict was $10,000 in economic damages. We don't necessarily know whether that includes any wage information. It's economic. It's $10,000. But the testimony, the medical testimony, supports that that could be a reasonable range. The evidence that was identified in Exhibit H, if you went back and looked through all the bills that were submitted by plaintiff's counsel and the testimony that plaintiff had insurance and then didn't have insurance, I think is very important testimony here because it shows who paid and it shows why it was paid. And if you have evidence of a billed amount versus a paid amount, and that's the only evidence you have, you don't know that. We're looking at a situation here which I think is distinguishable from Crossgrove and Tucker. And those cases, probably as you're aware, are Crossgrove is up on cert. There's another case, the Sunahara case, which we also cite in our brief. And I think those issues are significantly different from the case here. Those cases, and I'm out of time, did not have a situation where the parties wanted to offer evidence of reasonableness. And in order to do that, you have to put in, you have to be able to put in something, evidence of payment based on the longstanding case law in Colorado has been recognized as such evidence. And I am out of time, I don't want to run out. I do have other issues if there are questions.
Thank you.
I'll be brief, just a couple of things that came up just now. One other thing I think that should be addressed for the next trial is that I don't believe that Dr. Burton, an MD who did not witness the accident, should be permitted to provide the opinion that he did in this in the earlier trial.
Did you raise that issue in your briefs?
What's that?
Did you raise that particular issue in your briefs?
That Burton not be allowed to, well, what we said is we should have been, well, I'm not sure if we raised that. I was trying to answer the question about what other things should be addressed. It's an issue that might arise again.
That's true. There's a lot of issues that might arise again, but within the set of issues that you've raised on appeal, I think is what Judge Webb and Judge Casepo were interested in.
Okay, and so it may be best then to just raise that again with the trial court and take it up in a Schreck-type hearing about whether or not a doctor has the ability to do what the accident reconstructionist was not allowed to do.
You didn't file a Schreck motion on that aspect of Burton's testimony, did you?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
We didn't. I think that I can't think of anything else that could be addressed other than this collateral source. So unless you have any questions.
I do have one, and that is the question of, you know, first counsel got up and said, you know, basically say what you want about collateral source. It's a $15 verdict. They mustn't necessarily rejected anything about the collateral source and causation with respect to my client. What's your response to that?
Sure, I think that's exactly what happened. And I think that's exactly why you can't allow this evidence in to come in. That's what the Cosgrove court goes through and talks about. You're never going to know how two separate juries take this evidence. In this case, what I think was even more nefarious about their use of collateral source evidence was that they used it to support this idea of a low impact, you know, unlikely to support their causation defense. And I think that's even worse than have the court just after the trial. You know, what we wanted to do and what we were entitled to do under the law was to tell that jury that Ms. Speaks had $117,000 in medical expenses, period. That's it. Nothing else comes into evidence. $117,000, they stipulated to the number. Instead, we're forced into a position of saying there was $117,000, but only $30,000 of that was paid. Okay, that's what we have to do now to inoculate against this error. Otherwise, it looks as if we're not talking about the facts, and in opening, the defense gets to jump up and talk about only $30,000 was paid. So what they did, when you're looking at a 75% discount, okay, I think what this jury did, to tell you the truth, I think that they looked at this and they said that there must be something wrong with the causation. There must be some problem because only $30,000 out of the $117,000 got paid, and there wasn't any testimony about why that was, because we're not going to march in a bunch of adjusters to talk about, now, why was this built, when the court had also told us you can't talk about insurance. I mean, we were completely hamstrung. And there was no way to do this case once that ruling came down.
In your opening statement, did you inoculate the jury to the 117 versus 30 spread?
I tried to.
But
I mentioned it, yeah.
Okay.
And before that, there's a long letter about this that I made for precisely the reason that I was concerned that we were going to be told after the fact that, oh, well, now that you're dealing with this evidence that shouldn't be in, but now as a trial lawyer you have to deal with and try to use it, you know, as best you can, but you shouldn't be in that position. So you can never really go back and undo this. The moment the court said this evidence is coming in that shouldn't come in, everything happens from there, how the case gets tried from there, and that's why Cosgrove explains why it's reversible error, why there's no case in the country with a collateral source rule like ours, either common law or statutory. Not a single case in the country has ever used some sort of a harmless error analysis to justify and uphold a verdict where this evidence came in. And it makes perfect sense, and the Cosgrove court panel explains that, I think, very well, as does the Supreme Court. In Volunteers of America, and another option this court has, Cosgrove is service granted in March of this year on this issue of the admissibility of collateral source evidence, because apparently there was some issue, you know, in the Tucker Volunteers of America case, while the court stated that evidence shouldn't come in. That wasn't what had happened in the case, and so it was arguably dicta. And so Crossgrove, I think the Supreme Court has taken it to make clear that, yes, indeed, we meant what we said in Volunteers of America, but one option this court would have would be to hold off on ruling until the Supreme Court pronounces Tucker. Now, that could be some time. I don't know, you know, could... But my guess is that no matter what, you know, if this is remanded, there's going to be an opportunity to petition this case for cert and consolidate it with the case that's already up there. So that may happen as well. Unless there are any other questions. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your time, both sides. We appreciate your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.